food workers, you have migrant rights, immigrant rights movements. I mean, there's a sense that something is happening and people are aching for a better America that works for people, not just, as this Trans-Pacific Partnership illuminates most clearly, corporations.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Katrina Vandenhuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation, America's oldest weekly magazine. We will link to your website, The Nation, celebrating its 150th anniversary with a quintuple-length blockbuster edition of the magazine. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Brick, Renee Feltz, Sarah Mate, Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Malkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Gezder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley, Elizabeth Press. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Up next is the evening news, but first, these important messages.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the fourth annual Umbrella Festival of Circus and Comedy, April 2nd to April 5th at the Alberta Rose Theater. Four nights of entertainment, including outsider music legend Artist the Spoon Man, nine traveling circus troupes, acrobats and aerialists, clowns and cabaret, bands and burlesque, drag and daring do, and more. Again, that's the fourth annual Umbrella Festival of Circus and Comedy, April 2nd through April 5th at the Alberta Rose Theater, 3000 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film Occupy the Farm, playing at the Clinton Street Theater Thursday, April 2nd at 6:30 p.m.
Our main concern is water right now.
The university actually shut off our water.
What we're going to be doing is handing buckets over the fence.
Occupy the Farm tells the inspiring story of 200 farmers who occupy the last piece of farmland in California's urban East Bay, planting 15,000 seedlings to feed the community and disrupt plans to build a shopping mall. That's Occupy the Farm, Thursday, April 2nd, 6:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland City Council passes a travel boycott of the state of Indiana in protest of the state's anti-gay religious freedom law.
McDonald's says it will raise wages at 10% of its stores nationwide.
And New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez is indicted on fraud and bribery charges.
Good evening. This is the KBOO News. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 1st, 2015. I'm Paul Rowland.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. The Portland City Council voted today to immediately discontinue the use of a popular pesticide in all city-owned properties. Neonicotinoids are a type of pesticide that has been linked to the die-off of several pollinators, including bees. The pesticide is capable of staying around long after it's been applied. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg has more.
The use of neonicotinoids in the city of Portland's public parks and buildings will be phased out by 2017. The phase-out consists of several stages, including a plan that must be developed in the next 4 months to find alternatives to the pesticides. A pilot project looking at alternative pest control methods will be carried out at the city's two rose gardens, where a type of pest known as a rose midge is a threat to the roses. Here's some of the testimony from the public hearing 2 weeks ago in which 37 of the 41 people who testified were in favor of the ban.
As the owner of Live Honeybees, a Portland-based pollinator education company, thanks for hearing my views on pollinators, the canary in the coal mine of food security. They're suffering and they need your help. As a resident of Portland since 76, I appreciate the nearly four decades of leadership Portland and Oregon has shown regarding health and sustainability. Traditionally, we're the city of roses, so befriending pollinators would seem like a natural step. Portland also stands out nationally for supporting farmers markets, community-supported agriculture, backyard chickens, even backyard beehives. Our local pride was tested by the massive bee deaths in Wilsonville and Hillsborough. One of the silver linings was Congressman Blumenauer's Save America's Pollinator Act. We need that concern and leadership not to fade, because out of the limelight, the biggest threat marches on, death by thousands of cuts every season by neonics, toxin banned in the European Union, as was mentioned in 2013, banned also by Vancouver, BC garden retailers who today refuse to purchase neonicotinoid-laced plants from their wholesalers. Looking into the future challenges to health and sustainability, such as population pressure and density, climate change, declines in available gardenable soil, and continued lobbying by chemical companies, I urge you to join the EU, Vancouver, BC, and the National Wildlife Federation to continue leadership to ban the neonics. Ban them in bottles, plants, seeds, laced, and coated with neonics. Ban the sales from local retailer shelves. If there's a way and a will to do so, ban online purchases being shipped to Portland. As a public campaign, I see a public campaign and incentives for citizens to bring these toxins to Metro's recycling station. Leadership and caliber of this caliber would improve Portland's food security, reduce our toxin load, remove one significant cause of insect declines, both of pollinators and the invertebrate fish that feed on them, as they are both very stable and water-soluble. The work Live Honeybees does, removing swarms and hives from trees and buildings throughout the city of Portland, working often with the city of Portland, teaching the difference between honeybees and other insects, universally people feel a relief and a sense of community with pollinators, replacing those fears. In the end, we are a community not of just of people, but of a broader, more inclusive community that relies on millions of small pollinators and other insects. Please support and defend them.
The four people who testified against the ban were all from pest control companies and industry groups. The opponents to the ban focused on the issue of bedbugs, claiming that neonicotinoids were necessary in order to keep children safe from bedbugs. Christine Winson from Univar, a Washington-based chemical supply company, spoke against the ban.
I came in with a certain premise, and Commissioner Fritz, if you would clarify for me, because I wasn't quite sure the way this ordinance was written. You said that this ban does not include city buildings.
It includes city-owned property, but the city of Portland doesn't own housing buildings, for example.
Okay. Does the city own buildings?
We own this building and others.
Others.
Yeah.
So does the ban include those properties?
Yes.
Okay. So this is not just strictly an outdoor only?
Correct.
Okay. Right. So... Yeah. As Gene Camp had said before, we do have issues in buildings with bedbugs, with other pests. So within the interior of buildings, we have bedbugs, we have fleas, there are stinging insects. Taking this tool away where we have reduced risk to mammals, to people, to children, to pets, will be giving us the alternative of using other pesticides that are more toxic, again, to mammals, and in applications that will never harm a pollinator. So I would urge this commission to look at perhaps rewriting and opening up the opportunity to consider an indoor exemption for neonicotinoids.
Portland Mayor Charlie Hales raised the issue of bedbugs before today's vote.
Saltzman?
Well, I'm pleased to report that Portland Fire and Rescue does not use neonicotinoids in dealing with bedbug issues. In fact, I'm also pleased to say they don't have much of a bedbug issue, period. But when they do, they use heat. So anyway, I'm pleased to support this ban. I think it's an important important step towards helping our bee population. Aye.
The Portland City Council voted unanimously today to ban neonicotinoids in a phase-out program by 2017 in all city-owned parks and buildings. By enacting this ban, Portland joins Seattle, Spokane, and Eugene, as well as the European Union and several Canadian provinces, all of which have banned the use of so-called neonics in order to protect bees and other pollinators. For KBOO News, I'm Jenka Soderberg.
The Portland City Council also today passed a travel ban for city employees to the state of Indiana until that state overturns its so-called religious freedom law. The law discriminates against people who are gay, lesbian, transgender, or bisexual. Here's a clip from the vote on this issue.
Okay, we have one more item this morning, which is a 4/5 agenda item, item 343-1.
Declare City Council support for the overturn of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and temporarily suspend city travel by a public employee to the state of Indiana until the act is overturned.
Thank you, colleagues. I appreciate people being willing to put this on the agenda today. I wanted to give us a chance as a city to speak on this issue and to take a stand on it. I've spent some time over the last couple of days talking to my colleague, Greg Ballard, who's the mayor of Indianapolis, who also opposes the legislation that the Indiana legislature has so recklessly passed. And so I wanted to give us a chance to speak as a collective body on this issue, and that's why this is on the calendar today.
Saltzman.
Well, I appreciate, Mayor, you bringing this forward and actually establishing a travel ban by city employees to Indiana. Looks like we'll be doing the same for Arkansas. So I trust you'll handle that quickly. But this is really important to, call this out. And I can only, I'm trying to wonder why states are doing things like this. And I can only conclude that there is an element of the population in these states, Arkansas, Indiana, perhaps Georgia, that, fortunately have found out that they've been totally shut out from banning gay marriage. And, due to some tremendous rulings in the federal judicial system, gay marriage is here. And so in many respects, it's a lashing out by some very conservative, very religious elements because they can't lash out on the number one topic that really drives them nuts. And so they're going to number two.
Those are Portland City Councilors voting today in favor of a travel ban for city employees to Indiana until the state repeals this new law that allows for discrimination against LGBTQ individuals.
In 2012, the federal government reached a conclusion that Portland police regularly engaged in excessive force when dealing with the mentally ill. The results of that investigation led to the formation of a group called the Community Oversight Advisory Board. The committee will hold its first open community meeting tomorrow, Thursday, April 2nd, at the Charles Jordan Community Center. That center is located at 9009 North Foss Avenue here in Portland. The Community Oversight Advisory Board comprises 20 members, representing a variety of community stakeholders. Recent reports and comments from committee members have called attention to the city's efforts to properly house and staff the committee. Criticisms include locating the committee offices inside the East Burnside Police Precinct, seen by many to make it more difficult for the community to actually access the committee. Further concerns include the attempt by the City of Portland to void Judge Michael Simon's yearly review of progress on the agreement. Main meeting points will focus on whether officers should wear body cameras, if more foot patrols are needed, and what type of experiences citizens are having when they deal with officers. For more, KBOO's Paul Rowland spoke with a member of the advisory board about tomorrow's public meeting.
What's going to happen tomorrow?
Tomorrow, like you said, we're having the first ever public hearing. Basically, the compliance officer, the community liaison, and several members of the Community Oversight Advisory Board will be in attendance to listen to people's interactions with the Portland Police Bureau. And we basically want to hear why people don't trust the police and what they think that the Portland Police Bureau can do to better build trust within the community.
And so what do you see the result of this being? Where is this headed?
As we move forward through the next 2 years, we'll be gathering more and more information. And the Portland Police Bureau will take the information and incorporate the information into the community, into their community engagement outreach programs.
And Dama, what's your role with this?
I'm the community engagement agent, interpreter, and translator, and I'm just community member, you know, I just want to make sure that if there is Spanish speakers or if there is complaints, suggestions, recommendations, that they get translated and forward to the co-op. We have a Facebook page, is in Spanish, has the colorful picture that says respect, and it's called La Junta de Supervisión de la Policía. If folks know, folks, the other thing is that, you know, because there is no driver license chance for, you know, a residence here in Oregon, the state of Oregon. So I feel like the police has, like, you know, has an open, wide door, you know, very open to pull over, you know, immigrants who don't have a driver license and to do all kinds of stuff. So I want to make sure that people have a voice.
Okay. So anything else about this public? Anybody can come and give testimony?
Yes, we'd like all Portlanders to join us and be able to come to the public hearing, offer their experiences. There'll be a couple of microphones. There'll also be a way for them to write if they would prefer to write. They can remain anonymous. This is about getting community information, but most of all, it's about building community trust because it's been so damaged over too many decades.
Have you had meetings of the community advisory board already?
Yes, we've had, Paul, we've had two meetings so far. We'll have another public meeting April 9th, and that's up at the Montevilla. But that's aside from this public hearing, which is we're asking community-wide participation. We'd like as many people as possible to come share their experiences.
But you say people can also attend the meeting. And what's the purpose of the meetings of the Community Oversight Advisory Board?
The purpose of the meetings, it's manifold purposes. For instance, right now, we've just been able to get our bylaws instantiated. We've just broken out into three subcommittees, the Mental Health Crisis Response Subcommittee, the Community Engagement Outreach Subcommittee, and as well, the Data Systems Use of Force and Compliance Subcommittee. And in each of those committees, there's a specific tasks that are outlined in the U.S. Department of Justice v. City of Portland Settlement Agreement, and that's available at doj.gov if anybody wants to access the latest version of that. So in those different committees, we approach those and take care of those different workloads.
But again, what we were talking about specifically is, again, tomorrow afternoon, evening from 5:30 to 8:30, the first ever public hearing of the Community Oversight Advisory Board at the Charles Jordan Community Center. That's at 9009 North Foss. And I noticed that you had a phone number on this flyer, so I assume that's something I can give out on the air?
Absolutely, yes.
And, you can contact V, who I've been talking to. That's 503-975-0835. And I'm sure there's a website for the COAB. And
There's the city website that's run by the city. And then there is the COCAL COAB website, which is run by the city. And then Sharon Maxwell, yeah. Bud Fulis, and myself, Mila Vianney Perez Riviere, also have our individual COAB Facebook pages where you can directly reach us.
Okay, and we'll link to those on our website, kboo.fm. Thank you very much for being
Paul.
With me.
Okay.
Thank you, gracias.
A public records inquiry by the Oregonian has uncovered that several computer, laptops, and cell phones have been seized from former Kitzhaber staffers. On February 19th and 20th, the Department of Administrative Services swept through former Governor Kitzhaber's office to secure electronics related to the running of the office. The move came 1 week after a federal subpoena demanding records from the governor's office. The sweep was headed by Marshall Wells, a manager for the Department of Administrative Services. Wells was later placed on leave by the director of the department, citing that Wells had not properly authorized the sweep. The devices have been quarantined in the state's forensic lab until they can be properly analyzed.
In a surprise revelation, former Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber had once considered making it illegal for school teachers to strike. in an outpouring of data that resulted from the federal subpoena of former Governor Kitzhaber's emails, has been released. An email quoting Kitzhaber saying that striking is intended for profit-based businesses to give workers leverage in the workplace. Kitzhaber contended that because the taxpayers are the employer of the school district, that a teacher strike was an assault on the taxpayer. Kitzhaber outlined a plan for mediation of disputes to try to give both sides the best options possible while removing the threat of the strike. Ultimately, Governor Kitzhaber never pursued the legislation, and Oregon House leaders have approved a $7.2 billion package for the next 2 years to fund the kindergarten through 12th grade programs.
Medical marijuana advocates flocked to the Capitol in Salem this week to respond to a proposed change in the medical marijuana program that would limit the number of plants that a grow site may contain. Under current Oregon law, a marijuana patient may appoint someone to grow for them, and each grower is allowed to have up to 4 patients. However, there is no limit to how many growers may be at one site. Some growers use these guidelines to arrange collective gardens that are tended by multiple gardeners, often reducing the cost of medicine to little or nothing. Now Oregon lawmakers are worried that such large operations are overproducing and bleeding into the black market. Lawmakers want to limit the number of plants at any one site to between 24 and 48 plants. Advocates for the medical marijuana program are worried that this will lead to increased costs in medication. Further concerning the advocates is the fact that while some marijuana plants that are grown outdoors and are well cared for may produce in excess of a pound of marijuana apiece, smaller indoor gardens may produce significantly less. Limiting the number of plants in a site may simply hurt smaller indoor gardens and do little to stem the flow of marijuana from large-scale producers.
Bend police received a report this weekend of sightings of a cougar in a local state park. About 40 people were visiting the park at the time. The responding officers did not have access to tranquilizers strong enough to sedate a large cat at that time and made the decision to shoot the cat. While animal activists have voiced their dismay at the killing of the cougar, the surrounding community seems split as to whether it was the right decision. The Bend Police Department has upheld the officers' decision to shoot the cougar, citing public safety. The Bend police also stated that the officer was unable to contact the Department of Fish and Game before making the decision to shoot. This is the second time a cougar has been spotted and killed in Bend this year.
A recent motion by computer giant Oracle is asking a judge to rule that the state of Oregon gave up its protection from lawsuits in federal court when it made an arrangement with Oracle in 2011. The motion is part of a larger case that involves Oracle suing the state for copyright infringement in a federal court. Most of the time, states are immune from this type of suit under the 11th Amendment to the Constitution. However, Oracle contests that the state waived its right when they completed the deal for the doomed healthcare exchange. Oracle claims that its computer code is copyrighted and that because the state of Oregon never finished paying for it, the state did not have a right to display Oracle code or content. Oracle is in the middle of at least 4 lawsuits involving the state of Oregon and the failed healthcare site that they were contracted to build and maintain.
The OLCC has formally fired its director for the state's new recreational marijuana program. The OLCC reports that Tom Burns had been working on a draft proposal for the recreational marijuana industry. The draft introduced changes to the medical marijuana program, including whether medical users would have to pay tax at recreational shops, and standardizing testing procedures across the board for both medical and recreational marijuana. While the OLCC was aware that Burns was working on the draft, they contend that Burns crossed the line when he sent a copy of the bill to someone outside the OLCC office and then later deleted that email. In a termination letter sent to Burns, Steve Marks, the executive director of the OLCC, stated that Burns' employment was considered at will and that other factors in the firing included trust and professional judgment.
The Oregon Zoo announced that it has had to put down one of its star elephants. Rama the elephant was put to sleep on Monday after zoo officials said that treatments for a leg injury had stopped working. Rama the elephant originally sustained his injury 25 years ago when a group of females pushed Rama out of the herd and he landed in a moat, injuring his leg. It is normal for elephants to isolate males that are maturing, and the Oregon Zoo was criticized for not better protecting Rama. Since Rama's accident, the Oregon Zoo has filled in the moat and changed the way that they handle the pack. Rama first made headlines in 2001 when the elephant displayed a knack for painting. Rama's paintings have helped to raise over $100,000. Rama would have turned 32 today.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for news from the BOO, followed by treasures from the KBOO archive at 6. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather should be cloudy with a high around 58 and a low of 37. Today in history, in 1897, John Damara, an indigenous leader in what is now Australia, was killed by British forces after leading an armed revolt against their occupation. In 1939, the last Spanish Republican forces surrendered, which led to 36 years of rule by fascist dictator General Francisco Franco. And in 1986, armed communist rebels in Nepal attacked police stations in Kathmandu, seeking to provoke a popular insurrection. Our quote of the day is from Spanish military leader and anarchist Buenaventura Durruti, who was killed during the Spanish Civil War in 1936. He said, "No government fights fascism to destroy it. When the bourgeois sees that their power is slipping out of their hands, it brings up fascism to hold on to their privileges."
Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson announced today that he will not sign a bill that allows businesses to use religious beliefs to turn away LGBT customers. Arkansas joins Indiana in drafting laws that claim to protect religious freedoms while giving the legal right to discriminate based on sexual orientation. Such legislation has drawn the ire of critics nationally and even prompted Walmart to send a letter asking that the bill be struck down. Governor Hutchinson said that he will not sign the bill until it has been revised to fit federal law.
California Governor Jerry Brown has imposed mandatory water reductions for the first time in state history after receiving a dire snowpack report. Yesterday's report said that snowpack in California was at 5% of its historical average, and that snowpack levels were the lowest ever recorded for the state. Brown's emergency orders included mandating that urban water use be cut by 25% in 9 months, and that the state should streamline its response to the worst drought in history. Snowpack typically accounts for 30% of California's drinking water. California has endured 4 years of what the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration characterizes as a severe drought. Last year's winter was the driest on record for the state, and 2013 was the driest year ever recorded before that. A NOAA assessment of the drought stopped short of blaming climate change for the lack of precipitation, but concluded abnormally warm temperatures in the state may be due to human-induced global warming. In January, NASA and the NOAA announced that 2014 was the warmest year in Earth's modern history.
A federal grand jury has indicted New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez on conspiracy and bribery charges. Menendez stands accused of accepting illegal favors to a prominent Florida eye doctor in exchange for political influence. Menendez is said to have accepted campaign contributions, gifts, and plane rides from Dr. Solomon Milgen, an optometrist in West Palm Beach, Florida, in exchange for Menendez attempting to help Milgen's businesses. Milgen was also indicted for conspiracy. Menendez is a 22-year veteran of Congress and is the highest-ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He faces 13 charges, including 8 counts of bribery and 3 counts of honest services fraud. Menendez had previously denied any wrongdoing when news first began circulating around an investigation targeting him early this month.
An assistant fire chief in Indiana is under investigation for handing a noose to another firefighter. Assistant Fire Chief Rick Bax has since been suspended by the Marion Fire Department after he formed a noose during a knot-tying exercise at the station house in February. He then tossed the noose at a black employee. A disciplinary hearing is set for next week in the case, and the black employee who was targeted said that he's worried that his boss may suffer no lasting consequences for an act that he views as troubling and divisive. The employee says he feels that he was directly targeted since he is one of just 9 racial minorities on the 63-person force.
And in more news from Indiana, Indiana woman Purvi Patel has become the first woman to be convicted of feticide, as well as neglect of a dependent, after giving birth to a baby she claimed was stillborn and throwing it in a dumpster. Prosecutors base the charge on text messages taken from Patel's phone that they claim show that Patel was talking to friends about purchasing abortion drugs. However, no such drugs were found in either Patel's blood system or the body of the fetus. Patel's defense attorney also claims that the charges of feticide and neglect of a dependent are inherently contradictory, as one claims that she gave birth to a child and neglected it, and the other claims she ended her pregnancy prematurely.
McDonald's has announced that it will raise worker pay by as much as $1 an hour over state minimum wages at company-owned locations. The move affects some 1,500 locations, but not roughly 13,000 locations which are owned by franchisees nationwide. However, those employees will be given access to free financial planning materials. McDonald's faced stiff criticism in 2013 for providing financial advice to employees that included wages from a second job as a primary income source. The corporation will also let employees accrue paid sick leave at the locations eligible for the wage increases. McDonald's, along with other fast food chains and Walmart, have experienced growing pressure from union-led efforts to increase wages for its workers. The moves by McDonald's and Walmart's recent decisions to increase employee wages are likely to raise average wages nationwide from $9 to $10 per hour. Rallies and walkouts are expected to occur at fast food locations nationwide later this month as part of an effort to advocate for a $15 minimum wage.
Black liberation activist and journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal is still in the intensive care unit of a Pennsylvania hospital, 2 days after he was removed from prison suffering from diabetic shock. Abu-Jamal was reported to have passed out in custody in his cell and remains under armed guard while being shackled to a chair. He is repeatedly in critical is reportedly in critical condition. Abu-Jamal was convicted of killing Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner in 1982 and was on death row in Pennsylvania until 2012, when his death sentence was overturned and a sentence of life in prison without parole was imposed instead. His original trial for the death of Faulkner has been roundly criticized by legal observers and international human rights organizations. While in custody, Abu-Jamal has become a reporter and critic of the prison industrial complex. While police interest organizations and political leaders have sought to silence him, Abu-Jamal's supporters are asking the public to call both hospital and prison officials to demand more information about Abu-Jamal's condition.
Researchers studying polar bears in the Arctic have released a study saying that polar bears will not adapt to eating land food as their ice habitat disappears due to climate change. The report contradicts previous studies saying that the bears, unable to hunt seals in warming Arctic waters, were successfully turning to birds' eggs and berries as replacement food sources. The study concludes that while polar bears have resorted to eating new food sources, they are not effective replacements for their traditional diets. The report was the work of U.S. Geological Survey researchers and was published by the journal Frontiers in Ecology and the Environment. Polar bears were declared a threatened species by the United States in 2008 due to the loss of habitat represented by receding sea ice.
It's 5:31 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Good news, people. The boom is back. Good times are here again, thanks to an economic boom generated by, of all things, bad times. Tens of millions of Americans have been knocked down and held down in recent years by the collapse of jobs and wages. This calamity has led to a second blow for millions of the same families, who now find themselves buried in overdue bills for credit card charges, student loans, and other consumer debt. But there's a bright silver lining in that dark financial cloud. Only, it's not for the indebted families, but for a booming breed of finance hucksters known as consumer debt buyers. Believe it or not, in the warped world of high finance, there's gold in them thar hills of bad debt. Such miners of human misery as Encore Capital Group buy bales of unpaid bills from banks and other lenders, paying pennies on the dollar. Then, they unleash packs of their hard-nosed, aggressive collectors on the families. If they still can't extract payment, the debt profiteers turn to their meanest dog, the courts. Debt firms routinely file thousands of lawsuits a day against financially devastated Americans. They know that most debtors can't understand the legal gibberish in the suits, can't afford a lawyer, and can't mount an effective defense against the corporate lawyers. So, some 95% of these lawsuits produce default judgments against hapless borrowers, meaning debt buyers can then confiscate the wages of borrowers or freeze their bank accounts. This is Jim Hightower saying, this boom in vulture capitalism is disgusting. But worse, it's subsidized by us taxpayers. We pay for that judicial system, the judges, courtrooms, and endless rounds of hearings. Predatory debt corporations have perverted our so-called justice system into their own subsidiary for squeezing profits out of destitute debtors.
Newly elected Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has vowed spare no effort against Boko Haram after taking office next month. Nigeria's dissatisfaction with outgoing President Goodluck Jonathan's response to the Islamic insurgency has been cited as a factor in his defeat by the former military dictator. Buhari emerges victorious with 2.5 million votes more than Jonathan in what could potentially be Nigeria's first democratic transition between heads of state in the country's history. Boko Haram has led a 5-year campaign, killing thousands and kidnapping hundreds of people in the country's northeast. Human rights observers have also criticized Nigeria's response to the conflict, accusing the nation's military of indiscriminately killing and brutalizing civilians in an effort to defeat the insurgency. Nigeria's West African neighbor, Chad, briefly became involved in the conflict when Boko Haram, after an African Union force made up of West African nations, was briefly deployed but was later recalled. A massacre by Boko Haram in the northeastern town of Baga killed hundreds of thousands of civilians in an analysis of satellite images by Amnesty International released in January.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Efforts against Fast Track Authority for the TPP trade agreement are intensifying around the country. Fast Track means that the trade deal would just be presented to Congress as is without debate or amendments to get it passed into law quickly. Rafael Navarre is political director for the Communications Workers of America. Labor is united in opposition to TPP and to Fast Track.
CWA is heavily engaged in this fight to stop Fast Track for TPP. We've never seen a more united labor front against a single issue like we have in this case. We have every single labor union that signed on to a letter opposing Fast Track, and we've been doing consistent work since the beginning of this year. Moving into the next 2 weeks, we are continuing that effort and ramping up our work. We have town halls planned as well as rallies and drop-ins to different offices, and starting on the West Coast in California.
Teamsters Local 853 has started contract talks for Silicon Valley tech industry drivers who work for Compass Transportation. The drivers work transporting employees for Apple, eBay, Yahoo, Zynga, Genentech, Amtrak, and Evernote. Local 853 Secretary Treasurer Rome Alois says the Teamsters are committed to organize Silicon Valley workers and bring living wages and benefits to struggling low-wage workers in America's tech industry headquarters.
For the other workers, the other support workers, the janitors and the guards and the food service employees that are all third-party contracted out, this will give them hope. This will give them inspiration that they can do it too. The Teamsters are going to help them, and all the other unions are going to work with them to do that, to bring to the tech industry and the Silicon Valley at least a wage that the people that help these people make billions of dollars that they can't deal without should get a decent living wage, affordable health care, and something for their future.
The United Auto Workers Union continues to add members. In 2014, 12,000 new members joined the UAW. It's the sixth straight year of membership growth. The UAW has 403,466 members. The UAW says as a result of strong collective bargaining agreements, Ford and General Motors have added jobs, many of them the result of investing in existing plants and adding shifts. Some also were the result of insourcing work to the U.S. that was done elsewhere.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor. Bank of Labor has provided trust and fiduciary services to labor organizations for nearly a century. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
As you can tell, that was laborradio.org, not Palestine Today. Palestine Today will be coming up momentarily. First, though, Nuclear negotiations between Iran and the United States have been extended another day. Secretary of State John Kerry met with Iranian officials today in Switzerland and brokered for more time as the U.S. seeks to limit Iran's nuclear program, an effort that has angered U.S. ally Israel, the only nuclear-armed country in the Middle East. Details as to what types of nuclear research Iran may engage in are holding up the talks. Iran has maintained that the country wants to develop nuclear energy, while international efforts have for years centered on monitoring the technology Iran has at its disposal and whether Iranian leaders instead want to produce nuclear weapons. The negotiation deadlines were self-imposed by the Obama administration and are meant to produce a broad framework to be fleshed out in negotiations in June. Obama favors negotiations with Iran as Congress pressures for further economic sanctions imposed by the U.S. against Iran. Newly reelected Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed Congress last month in an effort to urge sanctions against Iran.
The Prime Minister of Turkey, Ahmet Davutoğlu, in a press conference announced that the state prosecutor taken hostage by gunmen Tuesday at an Istanbul courthouse has died of injuries sustained during the siege. Mehmet Selim Keraz reportedly suffered multiple gunshot wounds, including three to the head. The Turkish prime minister also stated the two suspects were killed in an ensuing shootout with police. The Revolutionary People's Liberation Party Front, or DHKPC, has taken responsibility in online social media posts. The post cited the killing by police in 2013 of 15-year-old protester Berkan Elvan as motivation for the kidnap and killing of the prosecutor. Kiraz was the prosecutor assigned to pursue an investigation of police misconduct in that case. Tuesday's courthouse siege occurred during countrywide power outages in Turkey, for which no official explanation has yet been given. Turkish media, citing investigators, report that a suspect killed by police on Wednesday was linked to DHKPC. The killing happened during an attack in which five heavily armed suspects opened fire on a police station in Istanbul.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, April 1st, 2015. Israeli forces invade West Bank communities, injure a civilian and kidnap others. Meanwhile, in Gaza, Israeli Navy attack Palestinian fishers. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. One Palestinian was injured by Israeli army fire after the soldiers invaded on Wednesday at dawn the Jenin refugee camp in the northern West Bank city of Jenin. The army also kidnapped two residents and detained three. Medical sources in Jenin said a young Palestinian identified as Ahmed Salim Annarousi, 19, was shot by a live round to his right leg, causing a moderate injury. Media sources said that clashes took place after the soldiers invaded the camp and searched homes there. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers kidnapped on Wednesday morning five Palestinians in different neighborhoods of occupied East Jerusalem. According to the Jerusalem Political Detainees Parents Committee, the army and police in occupied East Jerusalem have kidnapped 44 Palestinians in the last 4 days as part of the ongoing violations and assaults against the Palestinians in the occupied city. Also on Wednesday at dawn, four Palestinians have been kidnapped after Israeli soldiers invaded the southern West Bank city of Hebron, stormed and violently seized several homes, while one Palestinian was kidnapped near the northern West Bank city of Qalqilya. In Gaza, Israeli Navy ships opened fire on Wednesday at dawn on a number of small Palestinian fishing boats in Palestinian waters near the Sudania area northwest of the Gaza Strip. Eyewitnesses said that soldiers fired several live rounds targeting at least three fishing boats less than 2 miles away from the Gaza shore, forcing the fishers to go back. The attack is part of the ongoing Israeli violations to every ceasefire agreement mediated by Egypt and the Oslo Accords. There are more than 3,800 Palestinian fishers in the Gaza Strip providing food to dozens of thousands of family members. Moreover, Palestinian media sources have reported that two Gaza merchants have been kidnapped on Wednesday in the Eretz Israeli terminal in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. According to media sources, the two kidnapped Palestinians are clothing merchants and that they are both from Khan Yunis in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, April 1st, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Maui and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joe Aaron, Jimmy Tardy, Galen Sanford, and Tarina Aguilar. The producer is Mike Klepfer. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so go get a pen or something else to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Paul Rowland.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Here's what's coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. From 7 to 8, it's Democracy Now!, a news magazine hosted by award-winning journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 9, it's Voices from the Edge, progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective with host Joanne Hardesty. At 9:30, hear Press Watch. Host Teresa Mitchell brings you the news you're not supposed to know. From 9:30 to 10, it's Fight the Empire. Tomorrow, host Per Fogring will be speaking about the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on April 4th, 1968. Since 1968, the U.S. has been involved in one disastrous war after another, and this question arises, is America under a curse? At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and comments.